and welcome to the Late Kickoff Football Podcast. Happy New Year to all our avid listeners, and we are absolutely delighted to be back with you in 2024 after a short winter hiatus. I'm Jamie Guyon, host of the podcast, and joining me as ever is Mike Wood. Mike, Happy New Year to you. How are you doing?
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, mate. I'm doing good. Good to record these at 11:30 in the morning rather than 11:30 at night, I suppose. So, yeah, it's good, and hopefully we can few issues are there, air them out, and we'll just carry on from here.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. I know 11:30 your time, 7:30 my time. It was an early start with lots of early morning teething problems as I tackle the morning and also discover what is and is not allowed at this side of the world when I'm trying to get access to Premier League football. So we're going to have a slightly quieter episode this week. We will not be able to bring you the usual little snapshot clips throughout the episode, but that is something I will work on and discover where I can access them elsewhere so that we can continue to bring those wonderful little snippets of commentary. Otherwise, all good to go. Absolutely buzzing to be back talking about the Premier League. It's been an interesting winter period, and we come to you sort of halfway through this strange 5-5 winter break, double weekend worth of fixtures. Before we get into the individual games, what do you make of this winter break setup, Mike, with the games split across two weekends in between the FA Cup rounds?
I don't mind it, but it's odd and it's strange. And it was the fact that, what was it, Crystal Palace played Everton in the FA Cup, and I just like completely forgot about it. It was like 3 or 4 days after like Premier League ended and the winter break had taken hold, so it's not really much of a winter break for these players, so I suppose any respite is necessary. And I suppose if there is more respite and there is more time to get on the training pitch, then there's more times for better quality of games. So I think in some instances you've seen that, and you've not seen as many tired legs, and you've seen more quality football. In other instances, you've seen teams stick out the house, but that's probably part of their MO, to be honest. They're not great football inside. So I think that has benefits and its drawbacks, but I think in general, if players can get their breaks, then it's welcomed, especially by the fans as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I do. I agree with all that, and I do like the idea of a wee winter break. And I think a lot of the teams definitely needed it. I do find the 5-5 thing a bit peculiar, and also I know to an extent it's random, but it's the only time of the season where it feels like there can be like a distinct advantage to some teams by maybe getting to play in the second set of five games. So, you know, Arsenal might have Gabriel Jesus fit next weekend, but might not have had him fit this weekend, for example, and that's just an anomaly of the fixture computer. Equally, you know, Man City and Chelsea were without Haaland and Nkunku this weekend, might both have been fit by next weekend, and could have made a difference. So I do find that a bit strange. But I suppose the other side of the coin is it gives you an opportunity to actually be able to see all five games. You know, I watched 4 out of 5 of them, which is pretty good going, and I'll probably do the same this weekend coming. And it's unusual on a Premier League weekend that you would get to sit down and actually watch sort of 7, 8, 9 of the 10 fixtures. So I suppose from that perspective, it's interesting. Without further ado, let's get cracking into those games from the weekend. And the big one going into it turned out to be the most interesting coming out of it as well. That was Newcastle United 2, Manchester City 3. Generally, it had been a cracking winter period for Manchester City after missing a couple of games to go and become champions of the world. They came back not too far adrift and sort of carried on where they left off, Mike. This very much is starting to turn into the, the cogs turning in the relentless winning machine that is Manchester City that we've all been waiting for, kind of between game weeks 10 and 16. And the late 91st minute winner just felt like classic relentless Man City in this game and the start of their title charge.
Right. The fact that De Bruyne comes back, has a cameo off the bench and shows you that the quality that Man City have been missing, like he's still like an echelon above the players that they have. And of course, they've got really good, strong players into the fold as well. But he just brings something different to the side. And the fact that he's got a goal-scoring capabilities as well as his playmaking, Like he's just still at this age, and even with these injury problems, which will hopefully subside for the rest of the campaign, but he's just got that cut above everyone else, and it really shows you why he's such a pivotal point to this team. And when you throw in like the injuries that they've had, and to key players that perhaps got them over the line last season, like John Stones, his welcome into the fold will be massive for Pep. And you could see the emotion after the game, how much it meant to him to win that game, because he probably thought this is perhaps the turning of the season here, because Newcastle, even though they've been in kind of wavering form in recent months, had a great result against Sunderland the weekend previous in the FA Cup, and it felt like maybe that brought a sense of confidence back into the side. And now, even though they had like a mad 90 seconds where they conceded twice, City just motored on towards the end of the game and showed really the class overall and deserved the win in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. That cameo from Kevin De Bruyne was absolutely spectacular. You know, how often players come back from injury and you maybe... I don't think anybody was going to question if Kevin De Bruyne still had it, but whether it would take him a few games to sort of get back up to speed properly. And his two involvements in this game were both absolutely astonishing pieces of quality. Obviously, the goal, first of all, which... At very first viewing, just during the game at full speed, I initially was like, oh, has the keeper had a howler there? Thinking, you know, was it against Man United where, I think, was it against Man United? Was it De Gea that was just miles out of his goals and sort of De Bruyne scored in the first like 12 seconds or something by passing it round him?
It was Man United. I know the game you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a bit like, yeah, it's a really good finish and fair play for De Bruyne spotting that, but the keepers had a bit of a shock. And I just assumed that's what had happened until you seen it back and realised that, no, he's literally just passed it into the bottom corner from 25 yards in the absolute exact spot where he couldn't get it. And I don't know if you heard did you hear his interview afterwards as well, where he was talking about how he did it. And just the thought process was absolutely incredible. You know, he's saying like, he could see the way that the defender was trying to direct him to the right. So it meant his body had opened up more, which meant if he was going to have a shot, he could play it through the defender's legs. But if he was going to play it through his defender's legs, he had to play it with the inside of his foot, not the laces, because he needed more precision. And you just think, how is that all going through your head in one touch of the basically one touch goal? Like, it's just incredible the way the guy must think. And then the pass to Oscar Bob is absolutely ridiculous, because, you know, Oscar Bob looks like he's being marked pretty comprehensively as he's making that run down the outside of the box, and for De Bruyne just to sort of swing that in. I think Micah Richards on Match of the Day referred to him as a quarterback, you know, sort of probably four or five times, but it was a completely fair comparison, particularly for that assist. And it's like, I think last year, it was in the 6-3 game against Man United, De Bruyne had an assist for Haaland where he played across from sort of within the edges of the 18-yard box. And I was waxing lyrical about how ridiculous a pass it was. And I didn't think it was getting enough credit at the time. But it's almost like his 6th, 7th month absence is that old phrase, absence makes the heart grow fonder. He's come back and everybody's very much like, holy shit, like this guy's absolutely ridiculous at football. So, which is great if you're a Man City fan, and pretty terrifying if you're a Liverpool, Arsenal, or Villa fan. Because absolutely incredible stuff from a Newcastle perspective. Mike, they showed some brilliant resilience and spirit in that first half to come from a goal behind and sort of flip the game on its head fairly quickly. Two fantastic goals by Isak and Anthony Gordon. And that's Anthony Gordon now scored against, was it all of the other top six teams? So, well, traditional top six teams, Liverpool, City, Arsenal, Spurs and Chelsea, which is quite the return for him. And it all looked to be going well, but we spoke about it right at the very beginning about the tiredness in the teams. And Eddie Howe said in his interview that they ran out of steam at the end of this game. And if I'm a Newcastle fan, that's got to be seriously concerning, that they've had sort of a little bit of time off, a reasonably straightforward game against Sunderland, and yet they're still losing games late on here due to tiredness. And I wonder if that's something intrinsic in the Newcastle setup, in Eddie Howe's style of play. And, you know, they find themselves 10th now. And you wonder, Mike, is that, if that's gonna improve and continue to cost them in the second half of the season.
Yeah, the fact that they can't seem to make reinforcement signings, they've got so many players out injured, in part because the workload that these players have got to put in. I think I read somewhere like hamstring injuries up 96% last season. Oof. And muscle injuries are on the increase as well, just because of the level of performance that these players put in. They're finely tuned athletes, and because everything's done at such a pace these days rather than the games of yesteryear, that you're more likely to do your hamstring or your muscle injuries as well. But I think it's because Newcastle are so relentless in the way that they perform as well. They're so high-pressing, they're so kind of in folks' faces that they're going to pick up these injuries. But by the same token, Newcastle didn't make a substitute until the 94th minute of the game when Lewis Hall came on for, like, well, I don't really know the particular reason why he's left that so late, but he's not turned to, like, the bench, and you can see why when he's got Paul Dummett, who, of course, is a hero of the podcast, but, you know, a Premier League footballer.
Not have a bad word said about Paul Dummett, thank you very much.
At a Premier League footballist level, he's not. Okay, you're chasing the game, you don't want to bring on Lascelles necessarily, but you've got Matt Ritchie, Emil Kraft, who's basically reserved as a League Cup player nowadays. Karius and Gillespie are goalkeepers, and two boys who must be from the youth academy, Alex Murphy and Ben Parkinson, numbers 54 and 63. So you could tell that they're obviously stretched in these positions, and they can only really play with what they've got at this moment in time. And the front row of the first 11 looks great. I think you'd only say, even though Miley's gone into a game, he's probably not the only first team starter. But then you've got Joe Anton, who's just missed. He's going to miss the rest of the season now. So, like, Newcastle are kind of, it's odd to say, like, a Saudi Arabian team's strapped for cash, but in terms of financial fair play, of course, that they're kind of against the ceiling now, and they've not got any recourse, and they don't have many assets to sell out with the kind of key ones that they've already got. So it's no good getting one of them out the door to bring in another player, because then you've just not really solved the initial problem at source. So I think it's tough for Newcastle, and I think it was just too much too quick for them running into the Champions League, and just kind of when they first came in, not spending their money wisely enough. Like Chris Wood, what was he, 25 million to basically ensure that you weren't going to get relegated instead of Burnley. And while it's kind of shrewd at the time, in the long term, it's obviously kind of backfired. So, like, their issues are that they don't have the assets to sell to make up the money that they've got for these players. Like, they've bought, like, Anthony Gordon was a good chunk of money. Trippier wasn't cheap to bring back either. Botman, great addition, but again, he costs quite a bit of money. And I think that's where Newcastle are running into problems now. They just don't have the squad depth of the first 11 further down to able to compete sustained against, like, the top six, who are all have, well, sorry, the traditional top six, barring Man United and Chelsea, I suppose, in a sense that they can't compete long-term with them because they've just got much better and greater squads.
How much of that do you think... obviously, the sort of squad makeup is likely to be above Eddie Howe's head in the way that Newcastle's backroom staff are framed. But, you know, do you think that there's an argument to be said that Howe is getting a slightly easy ride in the sense that they've got the second worst away record in the league this season, only better than Sheffield United? They've only taken 5 points away from home. And they find themselves now 2 points behind a generally atrocious Chelsea side and 3 points behind, you know, an equally derided Man United team. And yes, they've had their injury problems. I don't think, you know, Chelsea and Man United fans would give them a huge amount of sympathy for that, given that their own injury worries as well. And they're in danger of missing out in Europe. And we discuss regularly on this podcast that a team can't do better every single year. It's impossible, right? But so you look for degrees of consistency and long-term growth. But for me, it would seem that missing out on Europe for Newcastle this season would have to be seen as a failure, and even finishing behind United and Chelsea must be seen as a massive disappointment. And Howe must have to take a bit of the stick for that, given that he knows the squad that he's got at his disposal, and perhaps he could, without giving up on his style of play completely, but at least do something different to make those away games slightly more profitable for them in terms of points.
Yeah, I mean, even if you just take it back to the last international break, and the games since, the in games since, they've got the worst expected goals against. So, and while they're great going forward and attacking, I think they've got the best or the second best. Now they've got the best attacking numbers in that time as well, even though they've played a game more than Arsenal inside it, which skews it slightly. It seems to be reverting back to kind of Eddie Howe's Bournemouth time, whereas they're playing like some nice attacking footballer, but they were so leaky at the back. And I suppose with Botman out and Char missing out a wee bit as well, that's understandable. And not having the side ability of both behind you playing that sweeper keeper role, whereas Bravka's more likely to stick on his line. I suppose they've had to adapt and change on the fly, but even somebody like Trippier, who's played week in, week out since his arrival, without few breaks, I mean, he must be pushing 32, 33, 34 now. I mean, eventually he's going to perhaps break down. And I think you've kind of seen that his tiredness creep into his performances now, where he's making mistakes and making errors there, which were uncharacteristic of him in the first 18 months of his time on Tyneside as well. So I think there's a lot of mitigating factors that go into it as well. But I do think Howe's getting a slightly easier ride because definitely overachieved last season, but this season they're underachieving by quite a distance as well, considering it's most of the same squad that got them there in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be interesting to see, because I think Newcastle fans still seem to be with Eddie Howe, and understandably so. He brought them Champions League football. He brought them a win against PSG. You know, I was chatting to a chap that I met last week who's a Newcastle fan. He was at the PSG game, and you know, he talks about that in the way that, you know, say Dons fans reminisce over Copenhagen from 2008. You know, it was literally like a seminal moment for him as a Newcastle fan, getting to who's our age, getting to go to a Champions League game and see them win that kind of fixture. And so Eddie Howe gets a lot of credit in the bank for that with the home fans, I think, because they've just had such incredible experiences under them. But that sort of sentiment is probably unlikely to sit in Saudi, you would suspect. And with the amount of money that they can throw around, and FFP doesn't come into it when you're discussing managerial appointments quite in the same way, that you do wonder that if a couple of high-profile managers were available, perhaps one, José Mourinho, that the Saudi ownership might start to look elsewhere. So unless they make two or three decent squad signings now in the next couple of weeks, you do question how it can improve, because the team is literally running on bare bones. But I suppose if he does go, he's probably not going to have done his credit in the bank a huge amount of disservice in terms of the job he's doing it at Newcastle. Just quickly bringing it back round to the City, we spoke about how their sort of relentlessness in terms of making a push for the title now. Mike, they conceded those two goals, but otherwise seemed kind of very much back to their full firing self. And I don't know, did you catch the FIFA Pro 11 that was released last night? And interestingly, a lot of those players were Manchester City, although they did have them playing a back three of, I think it was John Stones, Ruben Dias, and Kyle Walker, which are with no wing backs, which would be astonishing in real life. It was a 3-3-4-1 or something. That's not a formation.
Like, they've been incredible, and while they've been a bit unders this season up to this point, their underlying numbers still look good. And we've been through this before. How Ederson can't make any saves, looked poor in the transition. And I think it's Pep just balancing up where he wants the balance to be. If obviously if he plays Doku and he plays something like Foden on the wings, they're going to be more direct and more transitional, which gives up the kind of control he craves. But if he plays Grealish and he plays Bernardo Silva on the wings, you know the game's going to be more controlled and kind of settled, whereas they're not going to be as porous on the back, giving up chances as well. And I just think missing Stones is vital to the way that they play, just in terms of their defensive positions, because they've tried the Katanji and they've tried the Aki in there, and it's just not the same. It doesn't quite work the same. Stones is just an elite level player on the ball who can transition to that defensive midfield role with Rodri as well. And those two as a pair obviously lifted them to the Champions League eventually, as well as the Premier League last season. So I think they are going great guns. It's just about Pep fine-tuning and figuring out that balance. Now he's got 2 weeks until the... Or is it 2 weeks to the FA Cup tie, right, against whoever?
Yeah, yeah. So they get a clear 2 weeks off. Yeah, that's the benefit.
And I'm not sure they've got that in the FA Cup, but I imagine it'll be a heavy rotated side as well. So now they've got Tottenham, actually. That's quite tough.
Spurs, I was going to say, they got a really tough fourth round draw. Yeah.
But they'll game out, of course, they'll game again. That game where they played in the Premier League at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium was the last, just last month, was an entertaining game. Not again, a game that Pep would like to play, but again, I don't think he's going to be too disappointed if they drop out of the FA Cup. Of course, he'd love to win everything that he can, but in terms of priorities, the Premier League's going to come first along with the Champions League. So if he does the rotated side, kind of has a wee look, has a wee think of things, and then go back into the Premier League kind of fresh before the Champions League rolls back around, I think he'll be happy with what comes. Now, if his rotated side beats Spurs, all the better for it, but I think Pep, as we said, with how he was at full time, I think he's finally figured out maybe how the side's going to go. And obviously, that's heavy dependent on De Bruyne. And then we've not even talked about Haaland coming into the fold as well. So it's a scary thought, you're right, for the teams that are at the top of the table with a rampant City chasing them back.
Yeah, it's incredible to think the amount of hiccups that we feel like City have had, but they're 3 points clear of Arsenal in the same games.
Yep.
They're, you know, on the same points as Villa with a game in hand, and now only two behind Liverpool. It is ominous indeed. We'll move on then to Manchester United 2, Tottenham Hotspur 2. This was a pretty interesting game, Mike. It kind of went exactly how you would have expected for about 46 minutes, and then... So it didn't peter out is the wrong word, but it changed tone slightly. The kind of end-to-end goal after goalness dried up a little bit. Spurs became quite reliant on set pieces, but probably seen as a reasonable result for Man United at home against a decent Spurs side, showing a bit of something to hold on to the draw in the second half, which is a... I guess, and actually, it's a bit of a bonkers thing to say about Man United, isn't it? Holding on to a draw in the second half of Old Trafford. But how did you see this one?
I think it was really interesting the way Spurs play the same way, no matter who they've got in their team or who they're missing. Of course, they're missing Maddison, Son, and Kulusevski at this moment in time. And they didn't have their midfield kind of duo of Sarr and Bissouma either. So they missed like five key stars in their team. And they still played the exact same way. Everybody's still in the exact same roles. I think the only issue was the execution. And you see that with Johnson and Werner and Richarlison, it's not quite the same as you would expect with Maddison, Son and Kulusevski. So I think the only thing that stopped Man United from actually getting a hiding in this game was just the execution of the quality of the players. But I think in terms of what Tottenham brought to the table, it's still very impressive what they're doing. And while they don't seem to be getting into as mad games as they were previous, I think they're finally balancing out. They're finally returning to the mean. And what they've shown is they're a very good, capable side. And especially when you've got Udogie and Porro as well, as Romero and Van de Ven, this is a very impressive start at 11, and you've just got you've got Skip just making runs, decoy runs all across the pitch, which is all he's really kind of good for. I don't mean to denigrate him in that sense, but he's not necessarily got the technical ability as the rest of his teammates, but he does the hard shuffling work very well. I think that opens up a lot of space for these guys to run into as well, and I think that's why Tottenham got their chances. And even Werner, who he had enough shots, but eventually got his assist as well. I think that's the frustration with him. He's not an elite level finisher, but adding him to a squad that's kind of lacking forwards in terms of numbers, I think is a shoot piece of business. And if he does chip in with the odd goal here and there, then Tottenham could be heavily pushing for top four and pushing a few other teams out the road to get it as well. In terms of Man United, they kind of just are what they are, aren't they? They're kind of in transition, in flux, and they've still not got any real identity, which is kind of damning considering how long Ten Hag's been there for.
I heard a fantastic analogy. I think it was Nader Manuha, and he said that they're like a table foosball team, in that none of the sections are remotely connected. You've got four. You've basically got four defenders, four midfielders, two attackers, and they just do their own thing completely separately, and they have absolutely no influence on each other whatsoever. That's pissing myself. I thought it was incredibly accurate, because there appears to be absolutely no patterns of play here whatsoever. Like, completely different level, but it was absolutely fascinating. I went to my first referee training session here last week, and on the same pitch was the BVI National Under-21s team were having a training session. And, you know, sort of in between drills and stuff, I was just turning and watching, kind of seeing what they were doing, seeing what the quality was like. And for the last sort of 15 minutes, they were doing this drill, which involved sort of, you know, centre mid to centre mid, play bounces back to the same guy. He plays it wide to a third centre mid. While that's happening, the winger makes a dart down the line. Third centre mid plays a sort of through ball either over the defender or on the ground into the winger's path. The winger either whips it straight in or takes a touch and looks for the pullback. And they ran this drill going in both directions, like again and again and again and again and again. And I was like, it's so fascinating to see, you know, a team at that level, you know, BVI on the national stage are sort of only really propped up by your kind of like San Marinos and teams like that. And, you know, won their first game, I think, since 2006, like at the end of last year. So, it was fascinating to see that. And then I did a game on Sunday, and it involved some of, you know, I recognized some of the guys from that training session were playing in the game, and they were doing that. Like, I literally watched them do that exact move on the pitch: bounce, 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 winger, cutback. And it worked really well. And you think that if these guys can be taught reasonably simple patterns of play like that, in a sense that the third central midfielder knows the winger's making the run, so he doesn't need to look. He just knows roughly where to put it. The winger knows that the attackers know what he's going to do with the ball. If it doesn't come in first time, it's getting cut back or whatever. But you watch Man United and you think, and I'm sure they do work on patterns of play on the pitch of some description, but nobody seems to be able to spot any of them. Not you or I, and not people, you know, far smarter than we are in terms of spotting these things. And I just think that's such a damning indictment on players of this quality. And as you say, a manager that's been there this long. And was it last season that Ten Hag said, you know, people want me to play like Ajax, but I'm not going to do that because we don't have the players. And you think that, and I remember at the time we thought that was a slightly odd thing to say, but it's as if he's doing, just to make a double comparison here, sorry, so bear with me, but when Jose Mourinho didn't get the Barcelona job, the sort of theory goes that he started playing anti-Barcelona football purely to kind of spite Pep and Barca, and that's when Jose transitioned into this miserable bastard that he is, that plays, you know, the most defensive, boring football on the planet, was all in relation to being overlooked for the Barca job. It's almost like Ten Hag is like doubling down on this Man United aren't good enough to play the Ajax way thing, and he's just trying to make it as turgid as possible every game, because you actually go through their squad and there's no reason why this team should be as bad as it is. But it's coming to the point where you've got to genuinely question, like, where does this squad even go? Like, you know, there's absolutely no sign of improvement. I'm not aware of them being linked with anybody. Or Michael Olise is the only player they seem to be linked with, but I don't see how. You might disagree, Mike. I don't see it improves. I can see how it improves the starting 11 in the sense that right now he's a better player than Antony or Garnacho. But I don't see how it improves any of their issues in the sense that all they'd be doing is passing the ball to Michael Olise and hoping that he did something wonderful in the same way that they do now. It doesn't seem to be the type of signing that says, yes, we've discovered a way we want to play. This player is going to help improve that and just bring all-round quality to the side. And I suspect they'll pay a fortune for him. And it just seems like another slightly more exciting, but yet another sticky plaster.
Well, I mean, you look at their previous dealings with Palace as well. Got Zaha, didn't quite work out. Wan-Bissaka, I mean, kind of shaky. And so you wonder if it's just going to be another case where this is a talented guy, obviously, making his move and not quite making the impact because of the situation around him, not being suited to his means. Because, like you said, like there's guys there and they're all fine professionals in their own right, apart from Anthony, who's a disgrace. But like, we've got these, like, Højlund looks like he's a capable striker, but he's still very young and very raw, but he needs the service to come into him. And the only boy that's capable of giving him any service in that team is Bruno Fernandes. But the problem with Bruno Fernandes is, as well as the baggage that you get with him as well, he's too much of an individualistic footballer to go around being the actual key number 10 that you need as a playmaker in this team. He wants to kind of have as much of the ball as possible. And Garnacho, I mean, very hot and cold, but again, a very young player who can obviously provide moments of magic, as we've shown already this season. Rashford, again, an all-in-one runs very hot and cold. Not quite the instinctive finisher that you need to consistently at this level, perhaps, to be like a kind of, not like a Salah, but you know what I mean, like a guy in the wing who scores a lot of goals. And then you push back and you've got McTominay coming on for Eriksen. I mean, Eriksen was a guy who obviously died on the pitch not too long ago. His best years have passed him by as well, just because of age. Never mind that. Manu looks like a promising academy player, but again, will he just get run down by the kind of malaise that's surrounding him as well? You look at the defence, John Evans is back, and it's like everything doesn't seem to fit, or doesn't seem to fit at the right time. Brand's kind of getting over the hill. Casemiro's coming back. I mean, he looks aged as well. And like when you said about like the Ajax thing as well, a lot of these boys did play for Ajax. Onana played for Ajax. Martinez played for Ajax. Anthony as well. And then some of Christian Eriksen at the very beginning of his career played for Ajax. So four of your starting 11 played for Ajax, but then you're dictating that you can't play like the kind of Ajax way with the rest of the squad. That's fair enough, but you've got to be able to.
Surely you go about trying to sign other players that can play like that as well. And he doesn't seem to be doing that at all.
Like, it doesn't need to be the Ajax way. If you don't want to play the Ajax way, that's absolutely fine, but play some sort of way. And even if you want to play on the counter, that's absolutely fine as well. Like, traditionally, my United sides of Ferguson era were kind of better on the counter attack, and that's absolutely fine, but you still need to evolve and adapt and change the situation around him. Like, how can Ange come in and inherit a squad that was underperforming and look disjointed and still get the best out of them with like one or two additions and just good coaching? And it's like a lot of the Dutch coaches that come here obviously seem to be good coaches in their homeland, but when they come here they just seem to fall a bits, and whatever that is, whether it's Stam when he was at Reading, Ten Hag here, Frank de Boer for his four games at Crystal Palace, which was such a disaster that they had to ship him on from there. Like Martin Jol is probably one of the better ones, but Van Gaal obviously had his issues at Man United as well. I'm trying to think of, like, has there been many Dutch managers that have been a sustained success in the Premier League, and none of them spring to mind, and I don't really know what the kind of issue is with whether it's a kind of environmental issue or what, but they just seem to be cantankerous and seem to get into fights more so with the media and the players surrounding them rather than getting on the coaching field and kind of getting these boys organised and playing some sort of even just simplistic football, which doesn't seem to be working, and that seems to be it's a total mess at Man United. Maybe Ratcliffe comes in and organises some of the departments, takes some of the weight off Ten Hag and things get better, but they just seem to be a club that's kind of in sustained malaise where they'll have a good couple of weeks, pick a result from nowhere and kind of drop points at, say, like a Luton or a Burnley down the road, and everything's back to square one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really agreed with your points on Bruno Fernandes there as well. And something that I recalled from when he first arrived at Man United was sort of everybody was putting a really positive spin on his dreadful pass completion rate, in the sense that the idea was that he's constantly trying to play these wonderful Kevin De Bruyne style passes, and so quite often they don't come off, but you know when they do, they're defense splitting, they're game winning. And so his 70-80% pass completion was, you know, a really positive thing, but in a sense that exact stat seems to be turning him sort of into a luxury player, in that they need somebody to be playing 85-90% of successful passes in that area of the pitch to give the players in front of him the service that they require. And his constant desire to play World Cup winning passes in this team means that, well, given that United play so regularly on the transition and the fact that they don't necessarily have sustained pressure, means that, you know, he's wasting 1 in 5, 1 in 4 attacks every time he has the ball, because he's missed placing a pass. And it seems to be, we've discussed similar things where Garnacho loses possession all the time. Antony loses possession all the time. I don't actually have the list of pass completion percentages of all players in front of me. I can see that Bruno's is 77.8 this year in the Premier League, which seems pretty poor. But it seems strange that a team that are meant to be at that end of the pitch would have quite such a high turnover rate between their wingers losing possession and their attacking midfielder making incomplete passes. You know, I would be very intrigued to see how he compares to not just Kevin De Bruyne, who's the absolute elite, but, you know, even John McGinn, Cole Palmer, we discussed Lewis Miley at Newcastle, these sorts of players, and how his pass completions compare to them, because it just seems the kind of thing that's really hampering them kicking on as an elite side.
Yeah, well, for context, in the past 365 days across the Big Five leagues and the Champions League, Bruno Fernandes has got 71.6% of passes completed, which puts him in the 32nd percentile for attacking midfielders and wingers. But if you change that to all midfielders, and you can check this on FBRF yourself, he's in the bottom 4% for pass completion. Now, obviously, he's trying a lot of progressive passes, as you said. He carries the ball pretty well. But yeah, if he's making incomplete passes and he's not as hardworking as he is on the defensive end of the ball as well, he's putting his team under pressure in these moments. So it's detrimental to the fact that if he wants to play the Hollywood ball every single time, that's up to him, that's his prerogative, and if his manager allows it. But it's not coming to the success of the rest of the team. And he can't be one of these guys that are playing like balls that are more intelligent than the rest of his teammates. So he's just got to kind of think more about how to retain possession and not just always look for the killer pass, not always look for like the fantasy points, as it were, for goals and assists. It's like, how do you make the team necessarily better around you? And if that's playing 1-2s with Hoyland, whereas you're not putting him in a situation where he's just going to be dispossessed, then maybe that will help them in the shorter term as well. So I do think there is aspects of Bruno Fernandes' game which are great, don't get me wrong, but there's a lot that just is not suitable to Man United. And I don't actually think, if say he were to be sold, and I know his age would be a factor into it, I don't think actually too many elite teams would actually try and pinch him off Man United either, even if he was going for a reasonable price. And I think that's where it comes down to. He's great to a lot of people because he got a lot of fantasy points, but if you drill down to his actual game, he doesn't help the overall quality of the Man United side as much as he has this individualistic quality. So I think that's really where he comes a cropper a bit. I think his overall tenure with Man United has coincided him with being pretty average on the park as well.
Yeah, 100%. And even, you know, obviously being in the bottom four percentiles, absolutely atrocious. But even just being in the bottom 30% for attacking midfielders and wingers is awful, because that's, you know, guys trying to make the same passes that he is, and two-thirds of them are better at it than he is across the top five leagues and Champions League. That's not where you want your elite playmaker to be. And there's an element of, you know, stats don't tell you everything, and you can obviously see he's a good player, but I think you're right in the sense that I'd be very surprised if any other elite sides came in. It seems like the kind of guy that would end up going to Inter Milan, Juventus, you know, or if he was lucky, maybe PSG, rather than, he's certainly not going to go to Barcelona, Real Madrid, Man City, Bayern Munich, which is saying quite a lot when Eric Dier's just shown up at Bayern Munich and what people might have thought about him prior to that. Talking of transfers, these two teams have probably been the most active in both directions in terms of transfers. Spurs bringing in Timo Werner, who you've discussed there. They've also signed defensive support in, I've forgotten his name.
Dragons.
Yeah, exactly. Who's a young, talented centre-half by all accounts, who you suspect will come in to support Romero and Van Veen, at least in the interim. Man United, it's outgoings. Hannibal's gone out on loan with a mandatory buy in the summer, isn't it? 20 million.
Yeah, I believe so.
Euros without a buyback clause. Seen a few Man United fans disappointed at that, saying, you know, what if he turns out to be brilliant so short term, got to have a buyback clause? But I don't suspect that's something that they're going to have to worry about from the little of Hannibal that we've been able to see over the last couple of seasons. But they're the sort of primary transfers, I guess. For Tottenham, they just needed depth. Man United probably need quality, but it's not really out there, is it, Mike?
No, just to circle back for a second, I thought it was funny when I can't remember who went down injured in the, was it the FA Cup game, and they asked Ange after the game, would that mean that Eric
Dyer... Oh, it was Ben Davis.
Would that mean Eric Dyer might come back into the fold, or will he still, or could you do without him? He's like, nah, we don't need it. And it's like, how damning that you're playing two fullbacks at centre half in the first place, and Eric Dyer still can't get a game, and then one of them goes down and you go, nah, we don't need Eric Dyer, and then he pops off to Bayern Munich of all places as well. I thought that was absolutely nice.
It's a good move for him. Eric Dyer's a funny one. I feel like he gets kind of tarred with a bit of a Harry Maguire brush, but he's just slow. Like, he's not a bad football player by any stretch of the imagination. He just looks like he's pulling a horse cart the whole time. But fair play to him going to Bayern Munich. And absolutely mental if him and Harry Kane end up winning the Bundesliga and potentially the Champions League this summer. Like, it's quite hilarious. But I'm sure he'll probably end up getting a game there and doing absolutely fine.
I think it's probably scuppers Polina's move to Bayern Munich as well, because I imagine Dyer's not coming in necessarily to be the centre half. It's probably to sit at that midfield as well. So he's greeting into his Bayern Munich top that he was wearing before the unveiling that got scuppered as well, so you got a feel for him.
Yeah, poor bastard. He's either that, or he just hopes that maybe Eric Dyer isn't the quite as long term a signing. But you would have thought if Paulinho's definitely going to Bayern Munich thing was going to happen, it would have happened by now, surely. I can't see how that's going to wait till the end of the window again, which I guess Fulham fans will be absolutely delighted about. Anything else on this one, Mike?
No, I think we've covered it. Probably a good point for Man United in the short term, and it's a good point in the situation for Spurs because of their injury.
Yeah, absolutely. And it kind of keeps them arm's length from West Ham. Fifth might be enough for a Champions League spot this season, and they remain within a game of Arsenal and Villa as well. So I think they'll be pretty content with that, given the players that they've got to come back for the running as well. We'll move on then to Burnley-Luton, probably the only one of the three games left that's got a huge amount of interest to cover in it. And even then, the game itself was pretty hard to talk about, to be honest, Mike. The interesting thing with these two teams is just how much the gap seems to have closed between them. You know, you look at where they finished in the Championship last season and the gulf between the quality of the two sides. It's remarkable what being a Premier League side can do to kind of drag that back together between those two teams, because, you know, Burnley were head and shoulders better than Luton last year, and a draw in this game was probably fair. Rob Edwards thought his team should have arguably got the win, but a draw was probably a fair result all in all, Mike, before we come on to the controversy of the equalising goal.
No, I think a draw is fair. Luton have seemed to have adapted better to the division than Burnley, who spent a lot of money to be this poor. And even though they have a kind of form and identity under Vincent Kompany, it's just not be able to execute on the playing pitch as well. So they'll definitely see this as 2 points dropped, because I think for a long time the only game they actually won this season was against Luton, was it not? Or against the relegation rivals as well. So I think they'll be disappointed that they haven't been able to close the gap even more so. They're definitely a team that's underperforming their expectations, but still not to a wild extent that they expect to be crawling out the relegation zone anytime soon. But I think Luton are happy with knowing what they are, and that's scrappy. Not happy to be there, but relishing the challenge of being in the Premier League for once in a long while as well. And I think Rob Edwards is tapping into that, especially at Kenilworth Road. So I do think there's a lot to be gained for Luton if they go down and bounce back up potentially. Whereas Burnley, you probably kind of not worry for them to an extent, but it just looks a bit disjointed at this moment in time.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, Luton have all the hallmarks of a Sean Dyche Burnley side, don't they? That they kind of go down go down with their heads held high and then come back a little bit wiser, a little bit smarter, and can do something with it. Whereas Burnley, as we've said several times on this podcast already, are far more reminiscent of a Norwich manager.
Farker.
Yeah, Farker, Norwich team, in that they come up playing well, go straight back down, come up playing well, go straight back down, and then sort of Norwich question kind of what the point in that project is. Like, you're right, Burnley's wins have come against Luton, Sheffield United, and then the other one was against Fulham, which was slightly more surprising, but it isn't, you know, that's only one win in 21 against a team outside the bottom half, outside the relegation zone, sorry, which isn't fantastic. They're currently 5 points adrift. Luton one adrift with a game in hand from Everton, with Forest dragging themselves away from it, and Brentford have a couple of games in hand. Coming on to that controversial equalising goal, came in stoppage time. Alfie Doughty cross into Morris, who headed home, but it was the potential foul on the goalkeeper that had Vincent Kompany exercised. Match of the day said no foul. What was your take on it, Mike?
Yeah, I'm okay with it being no foul. Trafford's come out and made an arse, and it was never going to get there. I think it was just the fact that the Lynch attacker, I forgot his name now, obviously puts his hip across to kind of impede Trafford, when he doesn't actually need to do anything in the first place. But I don't think it had any material effect on the outcome of the goal. So for me, like, you get some jostling, you get some fighting for position, I think that's perfectly fine in football. So for me, it's a perfectly legitimate goal.
Yeah, it's this idea that, like, you are allowed to be on the football pitch. Like, Adebayo is allowed to exist and be somewhere. And James Trafford doesn't, you know, as a goalkeeper, just doesn't have an automatic right to plough through what's ever in front of him to get to the ball. And I genuinely think, and to be fair, I'm the only person that has sort of said it in this way. It might just be that others aren't interested, but I genuinely think Adebayo is more interested in getting out of the way of Morris to allow him to get a clear header than he is arsing himself into Trafford, because he doesn't actually look at any point. So he'd have to have some, like, sensational spatial awareness to realise Trafford was coming where he comes. And then, you know, Trafford takes the bump and his knees just seem to collapse, because you can tell he's trying to sell it. And, you know, it wasn't a particularly brilliant header. And part of the reason it goes in is because there's no goalie. So you think, like, if he doesn't come for it, or if he takes the bump from Adebayo and still tries to, you know, make a proactive impact on the game, he might keep it out. So I was really chuffed it wasn't overturned. And as much as anything, even for those that thought it was on the foul side of the spectrum, Micah Richards, for example, it certainly wasn't of the level to be overruling it by VAR. You know, it was clearly an opinion-based decision, and the referee had a pretty good view of it. So it was good to see that stood as it was, much to Vincent Kompany's annoyance, obviously. It's worth maybe mentioning... it's worth mentioning now, and we can also cover the Everton Villa game at the same time, because absolutely fuck all happened in that except, you know, the offside goal, which was offside, and Dominic Calvert-Lewin not being able to finish his dinner in front of goal. But the hope for Burnley and Luton is probably that Everton might be facing a second points deduction and Nottingham Forest as well. Let's say, for argument's sake, they both got 10 points again, seeing as that seems to be the precedent. It would put Everton bottom with quite a mountain to climb. It would put them 9 points behind Luton. And it would put Forest just above Sheffield United with 6 points to catch Luton on the same games. It'll be fascinating to see what comes of that, Mike, but you do think that is probably the only hope those bottom three newly promoted sides have, especially with Brentford, the other team down there, getting Ivan Toney back next weekend.
Yeah, I think Forest especially, I think if Everton get deducted another 10 points, they'll still be fine. I think they're still going to have the tank to overtake these shoddy teams at the bottom of the table. Because even though Rob Edwards deserves quite a considerable amount of credit for keeping them in touch with the teams toward the bottom end of the table, they're still a a poor effort in terms of Premier League standards as well. So I do think Everton would still have enough, even if they had another 10-point deduction, because I think Everton are actually a very good and capable football side. It's just the fact that their strikers are left one for goals. I mean, you look at, say, Calvert-Lewin had the finishing efforts of Doucouré, then Everton would be challenging probably for European spaces with the points deductions, because Doucouré's hit that was his offside goal with some venom, and you're like, Calvert-Lewin was just left one, and it's like the only place he could put it was to Martinez's midriff, and anybody else he would have scored if he got on target. So you could just tell he's been a player obviously lacking with injuries, but lacking of confidence as well. So I do think you've got a feel for him to a certain extent. But themselves and Villas and all into the Newcastle boat as well, the reason why they're not perhaps even further ahead of their expectations is just that their away form's been poor, and they've just not been able to execute enough on the road. And even though Goodison Park is a difficult place to go, they're left found one all too often. And it doesn't make up for the fact that they're so imperious at home, and their home form has been absolutely excellent. That's kept them in the top three positions in the league so far.
Yeah, absolutely. It was an interesting game, and Everton dug in and did well. I tend to agree with you. I think if they did get another 10-point deduction, they would probably find the 9 points over Luton that they needed in the second half of the season. They've already found that in the first half of the season with the points deduction. So, and you know, they put together a run of four wins without conceding a goal, and you just that's the kind of run that these three newly promoted teams could only dream of. And that's the sort of thing that would drag Everton back out. Even Forest under Nuno seem to be improving. They've put in a couple of really good performances, seems to be getting a tune out of Chris Wood. And so you probably suspect that they can even find that points difference as well, such as the disparity in quality to the three newly promoted sides. The last game from the weekend, Mike, Chelsea 1, Fulham 0. Fulham's abysmal record at Stamford Bridge goes on. I think there's no wins there since the 70s. It's pretty woeful. Chelsea, the better team in this game, but could have still thrown away the 3 points with a set piece at the end, because they weren't able to put the game out of sight of Fulham and relied on a penalty to get the points. It's just this absolute same old story for Chelsea, isn't it, Mike? It's almost difficult to say anything interesting about their performances, because it's the lack of cutting edge at the right end of the pitch that's costing them.
No, I've been saying it long enough that I think Chelsea are a good side. They just lack that conviction, and Cole Palmer is dragging them through games all too often for being a young player with little Premier League experience prior to joining the club either. So I think with all the money they've spent, there is enough of a squad there to adapt to it. They're still missing Chilwell, who's just come back from injury in this game. Reece James, if he ever sorts out his hamstrings, you know he's probably England's best right back as well. And you know that's a combination where when they've both been fit, and even though it's a small sample size because of the infrequency that they've played together, it's some force and that Potter would love to have. And I think the defensive centre-backs, while it's a bit chop and change, I think if that were to settle, you'd have a great side, especially defensively as well. And even this Petrovic, who's taken over the reins from Sanchez, who's been injured in goals, he's looking a real good assured goalkeeper. So I think there is enough in the side, even though we make jokes about Todd Boehly, that they are capable of competing. It's just getting the guys on the pitch, and if they ever do find that number nine at Chelsea have been kind of missing for, oh, I don't know who was the last really kind of potent
Costa
number is, yeah, so like, and even
just 2014, yeah, he was there. He came after Mourinho, and then he was there for the Conte league-winning team, which was 17. So yeah, that was his really good season when Chelsea won the league under Conte. Before then, being ousted by Conte the next year, in that weird Texgate. But you know, that's 6 years now since Chelsea. You know, 7 seasons since Chelsea have had an elite level number nine.
And like, you've had the players, you've had guys come in, and it hasn't been quite of the cutting edge. And even going back to like the likes of Shevchenko and Torres, who just never worked out at the club either. It just seems to be a kind of poison chalice taken up the reins of a number nine jersey at Chelsea. And even though Nick Jackson's shown in glimpses of being a good player, in other moments he's shown that it's a bit of an anomaly. So I do think there's enough in this Chelsea side where they should be competing at the right end of the table, and perhaps should be a wee bit higher up than the position suggests. But something just feels kind of off. Like the kind of vibes around the whole thing just feels off. It doesn't feel cohesive, and I think that's maybe where Poch needs to kind of sprinkle some of his magic of what he did at Tottenham, probably lifting the players be better than they were as a collective rather than individuals. And if he gets that going, then maybe not this season, but next season Chelsea will probably be fighting for the Champions League position.
Yeah, I think there'll be. I think Poch now will see out the season. He'll get another summer, and he'll get next season, which is good. It's something Chelsea have probably needed for a while. Is a manager to be building something and be given a degree of time to try and get it done. I think a few of Poch's interviews and stuff I just find a bit weird, and I've always been a bit of a Poch doubter, and that he did do very well at Spurs, but he never really got them over the line with anything. He won the league at PSG, of course, but you know, it was PSG, for goodness sake. Like, I could genuinely probably tell those players just to go out on a football pitch and they would win the league. So that in my mind, there's still been a little degree of doubt with Poch, and always has been, as to whether he really is at, like, I think he's a better version of Graham Potter, in that he's at a slightly higher level than Potter given his playing experience, but I'm not sure he's quite at the absolute sharp end of the elite managers. And some of his interviews, I think, I really don't like the way he's been talking about the League Cup. You know, when we were in the quarterfinal, he was talking about how important it would be for these players to play in a final and how good it would be for Chelsea to win a trophy. And it had very much like the reminded me of Jimmy Calderwood, who was talking about winning the Scottish Cup before we got put out by East Fife in the third round on penalties. And you think, go and just get through it one round at a time, Jimmy, before you start talking about lifting trophies. And, you know, Poch talking about that, it's like, yeah, we've still got three games to get through. And he was doing it again before the first leg against Middlesbrough. Like, no, it's really important for these guys to get to a final. That's what Chelsea's about. And then hopefully we can win it. And you think, Middlesbrough are no monks. Like, let's deal with Middlesbrough first, and then we can worry about the final. Lo and behold, we go and lose 1-0. And, you know, they might still turn that around. I think it's next midweek, is it? So they might still turn that around in order to, yeah, to progress to the final and probably get beat by Liverpool. But yeah, he doesn't seem to have that kind of va-va-voom excitement but ruthlessness that maybe perhaps Chelsea fans were hoping for. And certainly the Chelsea Twitter discourse is quite negative in relation to Poch, which I think is also silly. I'd probably find myself somewhere in the middle. But then again, you look at the league table, they're only a point behind Man United on the same games. They're within three of West Ham. Granted, West Ham have a game in hand. And so, you know, actually getting a European spot by the traditional route through the league isn't out of the question for them if they can keep stringing together results. And I think that would be quite important, genuinely, even just a Europa League or Europa Conference League place. As much as often English following football fans see these competitions as an annoyance, I disagree with that entirely. And by qualifying for the Europa League, you know, just about to do exactly what I complained about. If you win it, then you get into the Champions League. And so, you know, it's another avenue, it's silverware, it's building for now. I think that, you know, Chelsea have got to accept that they're very early in their transition right now with an incredibly young team that aren't going to challenge for the league next year, even with the addition of an elite number nine. You know, even if they bring in Victor Osimhen, they're not going to challenge for the league. And so winning a Europa League would be really positive and a step in the right direction for them, which I would be perfectly content with. The other side of the pitch was Fulham, Mike, who is a team that we've spoken about a couple of times, and it's always quite funny because we're either saying, fucking hell, they're shite, they're in a terrible run of form, or we're saying, oh, wow, we got Fulham a bit wrong, they're in a brilliant run of form, and they seem to have gone full circle and they're back to being in a terrible run of form. I can't even see the last time they actually won a game. 5-0 against West Ham on the 10th of December was their last win. So a fairly barren spell for the Posh London side.
Yeah, I think Marco Silva's a geyser, and it'll slowly come in the wash. I don't think they're up to much. Well, they had that mental spell where they scored like 13 goals across three games or something of the likes, culminating in that 5-0 win against West Ham. I don't know. Like, Raúl Jiménez was going through a hot streak there. Not quite convinced he's the Raúl Jiménez of old. Still, Willian has been entrusted. He's probably the best player. He's 35 or older now as well. I just don't think they've got much about them. I don't think they're that interesting, and I don't think they play that great football either. So it's a combination of a trio of just kind of sticking around the league, and like you kind of fear for them, not this season, but next season if they don't get their house in order, if they do slip back to the championship, as they have done a few times under the Cairns ownership as well. So I think you've said this before as well, it's like there's a lot of teams kind of wrestling on the laurels this season because they know they're not going to relegate, and that's absolutely fine. But are you making contingency plans for next season if three teams come up and are able to compete? That are you going to be the ones that are going to get caught on the back foot and find yourself scrambling around in January to sign Big Sam to try and save you once again? And it's like that's not the situation you want to put yourself in. And I worry that's what Fulham are kind of sleepwalking to. I mean, they give Silva a new contract recently, and I'm fine if they believe that's the guy that's going to take them forward for the future. That's all good and well, but I do worry for them next season if they don't kind of improve, especially player wise. I mean, Pumpkin has come back from nowhere. This is a guy that barely got a game in the last kind of two iterations that they're in the Premier League, and now he's suddenly starting. And while he's always been a good, competent player, again, he's another one pushing into the 30s as well. It's like that's not necessarily the future of Fulham Football Club, and I think that's where the worries lie. It's like it doesn't look long term; it looks very short term for Fulham at the moment.
Yeah, and you look at the Championship as well. I think you make a really salient point there, Mike, that Fulham might be fine this season, but could very much be sleepwalking into a disaster next year, because it was quite clear even before this season started for those sorts of teams that Sheffield United were fortunate to get promoted anyway and had overachieved and then lost all their best players. And so it was incredibly unlikely they were going to be able to do very much. Luton were Luton. And then this was a completely new iteration of Burnley that had all the hallmarks of a Fulham or a Norwich that were, you know, playing great football, but unlikely to replicate it in a higher division. You compare that to the teams that could come up next season. You've got a rampant Leicester City that would have been incredibly disappointed to get relegated, have retained a lot of their quality and continue to improve at the top of the Championship. And they'll come up with experience and knowledge of the Premier League that none of this year's three teams had. Southampton, very, very similar story for them. Leeds United, very similar story for them. You know, reasonably established Premier League sides in recent years that will be disappointed to find themselves back in the Championship, all of which would be expected to come up and do damage to Premier League teams with players in their squad with plenty of Premier League experience. The only one that is different is your Ipswich, who perhaps have a sort of Burnley, Norwich and Fulham of old about them and might come up and play in great football. But then again, everything Kieran McKenna's doing there is so positive that perhaps you wouldn't put it past him to continue to learn and adapt in a higher division. But you're absolutely right. I hadn't really thought about it in that way, but Fulham could be setting themselves up for a bit of a disaster next year. And so could a lot of other teams. You know, Palace arguably don't move on from Roy Hodgson towards the end of this season or in the summer. They could be facing a similar issue, particularly if they lost Michael Olise. Brentford have struggled massively in the last sort of 3 months, and granted they're without Mbeumo and Tony, and they've got Tony to come back, so we'll see what impact that has. But yeah, there's a lot of teams, like you say, resting on their laurels a little bit that'll probably be absolutely fine this year, but could really, really struggle if they don't sort of start to make improvements. And yeah, Fulham are a sort of what I accused Crystal Palace of being before Patrick Vieira came in and then was a bit interesting, in the sense that they're just not remotely interested in the slightest. Like, I couldn't care less. The only time I notice their games is if they're playing Chelsea, really, or when they stick 2-5-0 wins up back-to-back, and you think, bloody hell, that's weird. But generally speaking, if I see Fulham on the telly against basically anybody, I'm not remotely interested in them. I think the last 90 minutes not involving Chelsea I watched was their game against Man United, the 1-1 draw, and that was boring. And they very much contributed to quite how boring that game was. So I think I tend to agree with you that Marco Silva is a bit of a geyser. And you know, perhaps being saved a little bit by the fact that the fans are so unhappy with the ownership there and the prices and the protests that are going on as well. That's everything for these games, Mike, assuming you don't have anything else to add on Fulham. Perhaps a quick look ahead to next weekend's fixtures with the second half of the Premier League. We've discussed a little bit about Brentford, but you've got Arsenal, Crystal Palace, who I suspect you'll be looking for a slightly better attacking display by Arsenal, given some of their recent performances. But that's probably the only game that stands out. You know, Liverpool, Bournemouth could be interesting, but you expect Liverpool to kick on. Sheffield United, West Ham is only going to go one way. Maybe Brentford, Nottingham Forest is interesting in the sense that they are two teams that could get dragged back down and Forest with those charges above them. Anything of interest for you there, Mike?
Brighton Wolves could potentially be interesting. Gary O'Neill, of course, Yuri's biggest fan. Roberto De Zerbi,
best English manager on the planet.
I'm the Roberto De Zerbi's biggest fan, so that could be the interesting one for the podcast point of view. I mean, Bournemouth have been very good at home, but like I said, they've kind of had an easy schedule over the last couple of months, and you wonder if that's kind of papered over some of the cracks that Iroha had early on in the campaign when he had a difficult start. But I think that Liverpool should be able to overcome that challenge, even though I think it could be a tough test. West Ham, Sheffield United, two teams that don't want the ball, so that'll be interesting. The first game where no player touches a ball. Brentford versus Nottingham Forest, that just feels very bland. Of course, the only interesting part of that is, I think Tony's return fixture.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So that's an Arsenal against Crystal Palace. I mean, Arsenal struggled to break teams at the best of times. So one of the last things you want to come up against is that organised Roy Hodgson defence. So I think they all have their merits. I don't think we're going to see necessarily similar games of football, though. And I think that's the only thing that's going to maybe come out in the wash. I think these will all be very tactical, astute battles, but whether we have the entertaining football that can come along with it, I think there may be a bit of lacking this weekend. Next weekend.
But obviously still listen next week where we talk about those bland, tacticalless 0-0 draws across.
There's the Scottish Cup, and I'm sure there'll be a few shocks in there that people will want.
Yeah, well, Aberdeen are definitely going to get beat by Clyde, so we'll have to cover that at some point. I do think the Tony return's interesting because I've seen a lot of discourse in newspapers and on Twitter, or X, sorry, about, will Tony still have it? Will he still be able to do it? I was like, the guy wasn't even injured. Like, there's absolutely no reason why he shouldn't be able to do it. He hasn't played a game for 6 months. You know, it's not like he's coming back from a horrible leg break or a hamstring injury or a clash of heads where you think, you know, is he going to be as brave? Is he going to be the same quick player? He's literally exactly the same guy who has had 6-7 months. Well, he wasn't allowed to train for 3 or something, was he? But he's had sort of 3-4 months purely to improve himself. So, you do suspect he'll come back and be exactly the same. Whether Brentford are able to supply him will be probably the bigger question. But it's been an absolute pleasure, Mike. Fantastic to be back after a fairly extensive winter break for us and talking about the games. Really enjoyed the morning slot that we've got going here and hopefully it'll be slightly smoother in the weeks to come as we get used to the morning slot. But I feel vastly more awake at the end of the podcast than I usually do when we're finishing at the back end of midnight. So that's been great. Thanks very much for joining me and look forward to speaking to you again next week.
Yes, you will do.